From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're ending the year with a week of entertaining interviews from 2008. On today's Fresh Air, three people who helped make this a great year for political satire. We'll hear from Saturday Night Live's head writer and Weekend Update co-anchor, Seth Meyers, his predecessor, Tina Fey, who returned this season to play Sarah Palin, and Stephen Colbert, who covered the election on The Colbert Report. Also, music critic Milo Miles considers the 25th anniversary of the public radio New Age music show Hearts of Space. Milo says the show has evolved, and so has his attitude toward its music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending the year with a series of entertaining interviews from 2008. Today, political satire. It was a big year for Saturday Night Live. A little later, Tina Fey will describe how she did her Sarah Palin impression. First, we hear from Seth Meyers. He's been Saturday Night Live's head writer and the co-anchor of Weekend Update since the fall of 2006, after Tina Fey left to develop her sitcom 30 Rock. Meyers was the lead writer on all but one of the Sarah Palin sketches. This is his eighth season with the show. Let's start with the Saturday Night Live sketch, which featured appearances by both Tina Fey and the real Sarah Palin. In this part of the sketch, Palin is backstage talking with producer Lorne Michaels. Alec Baldwin comes by but thinks Lorne is talking with Tina Fey dressed as Palin.
Hey, Lorne. Hey, Tina. Lorne, I need to talk to you. You can't let Tina go out there with that woman. She goes against everything we stand for. I mean, good Lord, Lorne. They call her, what's that name they call her? Cara, what do they call her again, Tina?
That'd be Caribou Barbie.
Caribou Barbie. Thank you, Tina. I mean, this is the most important election in our nation's history, and you want her, our Tina, to go out there and stand there with that horrible woman? What do you have to say for yourself?
Alec, this is Governor Palin.
Hi there.
I see. Forgive me, but I feel I must say this. You are way hotter in person.
Why, thank you.
I mean, seriously. I mean, I can't believe they let her, you know, play you. You know?
Thank you. And I must say, your brother Stephen is my favorite Baldwin brother.
You are a delight. Now, come, let me take you for a tour of the studio. You know I've hosted the show how many times, Lorne?
175.
I spoke with Seth Meyers 2 weeks after that sketch aired and asked him about making arrangements with the Palin campaign for her appearance.
I have to say, dealing with their campaign was really easy. We sent that sketch pretty close to the forum that ended up on TV to them, and they approved it on Thursday. And we added the Amy Poehler, Sarah Palin rap that we did on Saturday. But the cold open was, they were very, very good with it from the beginning.
So is it always that way that the campaign has final approval of anything that their candidate is going to be in?
Yes, but to be fair, like, so does every host. You know, I think it's, you know, people forget on the show that every, you know, people give you a week of their time, or, you know, a campaign gives you a day of their time. They're obviously not going to just show up and see a cue card when they're on camera. And so it's always a process with everyone who is, you know, kind enough to sacrifice their time for our show. But yeah, some campaigns are trickier to deal with than others, but hers was they were a game from the start, and she was a very good sport.
Did they give you any ground rules in advance about what she might not be willing to do?
They did not. And we had, you know, we asked, because obviously it makes it easier for us if we know there are ground rules. Again, we do know that they're running for president, or in this case, vice president. So we try to make sure our first draft is not so unpalatable that they'll reject it out of hand. So we start from a position of trying to be reasonable. But yeah, they were very easy to deal with. Historically, I found that Republicans are more game with sketches than Democrats.
Well, really, why do you think that is?
I think that Democrats are worried if they do a sketch, Republicans will use it against them, and Republicans know that Democrats won't.
Let's get back to Sarah Palin on Saturday Night Live. And once you agreed on the date, and the date was almost there, what was the process like of figuring out, so now what are we going to do with her?
You know, we, from the very beginning, the idea was going to be that it was going to be a backstage piece where Lorne was wishing she had agreed to do it. And then we sort of spun it out from there. Obviously, we have the benefit of being able to get someone like Alec to come by and do us a favor. And Alec was sort of
Alec
perfect.
Alec Baldwin, yeah.
Yes, Alec Baldwin, who's the perfect person, both because he's, you know, Tina's co-star and a very vocal liberal. And again, you know, I want to point out that also Alec was willing to make fun of himself in that scene as well, which is why it worked, I feel like, on the balance part of it.
Let's talk about another sketch that you... that you wrote, or largely wrote, and this was a sketch about John McCain's political ads, the campaign ads. And we always hear his voice at the end of those ads saying, "I'm John McCain and I approve these ads." And of course, there's been a lot of discussion about how John McCain, who promised you know, to run a really kind of civil, respectful campaign has ended up having all these really negative ads. So in this sketch, Kristen Wiig plays the consultant who's overseeing the ads, and Bill Hader does the voice of like the most like cynical narrator for campaign commercials, and Daryl Hammond plays John McCain. So here's Kristen Wiig kicking off the sketch.
You ready to go?
I'm ready to go, yes, but let me stress the goal of these ads are not only to support my campaign, but also to raise the level of the integrity in the political discourse, my friends. That was my promise to America.
Wow, that's so great to hear. Let's do it.
Barack Obama says he wants universal health care. Is that so? Healthcare for the entire universe? Including Osama bin Laden? I think we'll pass. No way, no how, no Obama.
My friends, can I ask a question?
Of course.
Is this ad true?
Well, universal has more than one meaning. We take it to mean the entire universe.
Works for me. I'm John McCain. I approve this message.
Great, let's do the next one.
Barack Obama plays basketball. Charles Barkley plays basketball. Is Charles Barkley qualified to lead our economy? He gambled millions away in Las Vegas. Don't let Barack Obama gamble with our economy. No way. No how, no Chirac O'Barkley.
Excuse me.
Yes?
Are those facts accurate?
Yes, the senator does play basketball. Charles Barkley also plays. Charles Barkley lost money in Vegas.
Well, I can't argue fact. I'm John McCain. I approve this message.
Doing great, Senator.
Seth Meyers, can you talk about generating the idea for that sketch?
Yeah, well, I wanted to do a sketch about, like, it, as you said, I think John McCain made a big point of keeping the discourse high and the integrity of his campaign high. And particularly it was the ad about the sex education bill that they were running that seemed so lascivious that I think put that idea in our heads.
The one that made it seem like Barack Obama was behind a bill in Illinois that taught sex education to kindergarten kids.
Yes. And it was an ad that you saw John McCain asked about a lot, and he sort of stood behind it still. And also, you know, when McCain sort of was using people that had worked on the 2000 campaign, Bush's 2000 campaign, that, you know, just it was hard not to sort of stay away from that.
Now, there was another sketch in which, and this was a Weekend Update sketch, in which Sarah Palin is at the Weekend Update desk with you and Amy Poehler. And she says, you know, I'm not going to do that sketch that you wrote for me. I'm not going to do that rap because I think it would be bad for the campaign. And so instead, Amy Poehler does it. Had you actually written that rap expecting Governor Palin to do it, or was part of the joke the whole time that you would write it and she would say, I can't do it, and then Amy Poehler would be the one to do it?
Yeah, that was always the idea, was that she would say no. We do a Weekend Update joke read on Friday night, and it was around 10 o'clock at night. And for some reason, Amy started freestyle rapping as if she was Sarah Palin. And we sort of instantly were like, we should write a hardcore rap, and the joke should be that she won't do it, and then you'll do it. And we, at that time, did not think it would ever be on television. But Lauren had asked us to come up with something to use her, to use Sarah Palin on Weekend Update. And we were having a hard time trying to come up with what we would do. So we came up with that idea. And then Amy wrote that Friday night. And I'm going to say it's one of the greatest performance moments in the history of Saturday Night Live.
One of the things that's really funny about it, I mean, it's like you're sitting next to the real Governor Palin. As
yes.
This really funny rap about her is being done by Amy Poehler. And as Amy Poehler is rapping, there's like a moose that comes out and gets shot down gangster style. And,
yes.
You know, her backup rappers are two like Eskimos and like Eskimo garb. You know, Todd Palin, you know, the persona Todd Palin comes out and starts rapping too. And it's just like really funny. And, I mean, the joke is in part on Sarah Palin, and she's sitting next to you. How awkward was that?
It was more surreal than awkward, I have to say. Like, the whole, I mean, again, especially since we started writing it on Friday night, you know, so the first time it was on its feet was Saturday afternoon. You know, every time we did it, Sarah Palin was with us. And, again, she never seemed to have any doubt about it and thought it was all in good fun. And it was in good fun, you know. I mean, it was a heightened reality of things that are true about her. And also, we sort of sold it to her as the joke here is that you have really good judgment because this would be a bad thing for you to do. The initial version had a few lines that we had to take out because they were a little too hardcore. Each one of them, I would say, they were absolutely right to ask us to take out.
Can you give us an example?
I'm trying to think. I probably shouldn't. Yeah, I can. I mean, well, like, I think there was a line, when I'm in Alaska, it's drill, baby, drill, that might have had a more sexual connotation in an earlier version.
Okay. All right.
And they, again, like I would like to say, they showed excellent judgment.
My guest is Seth Meyers, Saturday Night Live's head writer and Weekend Update co-anchor. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I recorded in October with Seth Meyers, Saturday Night Live's head writer and co-anchor of Weekend Update. Let's hear you on Weekend Update. And this has to do with the financial meltdown. Here we go.
On Thursday, your grandfather finally admitted that he screwed up the economy. While speaking before Congress on Thursday, Alan Greenspan, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, said he was shocked his ideas led to the current economic crisis and said, "I still do not understand exactly how it happened." Well, let me see if I can give it a shot. Banks bundled mortgages that had been given to people that wouldn't even qualify for jury duty and then sold those along with credit default swaps, which are basically insurance that the seller provides to the buyer in case the entity loses value. However, unlike regular insurance, these swaps weren't regulated, so they failed to meet any standards of responsible business. Then when everything collapsed, it spread like an infection, because when people are making money, they don't ask how, they just say, "Yay," but again, you're the expert.
That was excellent. I have to say, I thought that was a wonderful one-paragraph description of what happened to the economy. So did you consult economists before writing that?
I would have to give my thanks to Steve Croft in 60 Minutes because they did a piece on it about 3 weeks ago. And then I was very happy to see this Sunday they did a follow-up piece to it. So I felt like I'd gotten there a day early talking about it in this cycle. But that was the piece that I sort of saw that explained it to me. So I will give credit where credit's due.
So what's the process like of writing for Weekend Update? Like, how much time do you have to follow the news? What are your main news sources?
Well, I sort of spend my first half of the week focusing on the rest of the show as sort of the head writer of the rest of the show. And we have three incredibly talented Weekend Update writers, Doug, Alex, and Jessica, who do all the joke writing. And then the rest of the staff will write jokes as well sort of later in the week, and I'll write some jokes as well. Like, I wrote that Greenspan joke, but I think that may have been the only joke that I had written this past Saturday. But we get together on Friday night, and we read a bunch of jokes, and it's almost 800 jokes. And we cut that down to about 100 that we like, and then Doug, who produces it, cuts it down to about 30. And, you know, it ends up being around, 18 to 20 jokes come Saturday night.
Do you feel different doing Weekend Update than you felt when you were a cast member doing impressions of people, you know, Ryan Seacrest, John Kerry?
Oh, absolutely. Here's the thing about me, and I hate to let this secret out. I have very little range as a performer. So for me to sit behind a desk and tell jokes, that is way closer to sort of what I was doing before I was on Saturday Night Live. And I feel a lot more comfortable doing that. So I also, as a writer, you know, when I started on the show, you know, one of the jobs as a cast member is you sort of write for yourself. And, you know, I enjoyed that a great deal, but becoming a head writer and getting to write for everybody else is way more liberating.
Now, during the primary campaign, There was a sketch of one of the debates between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama that made it seem like the media was really kind of pampering and catering to Obama. And Hillary kind of referred to that sketch in complaining that the press was in favor of Obama and treating him differently than her. What was the reaction to her comment about that behind the scenes at Saturday Night Live?
Well, we were all watching the debate, and it was like the craziest place to get a shout out was during a debate you were watching so that you could watch, write a sketch about it, you know, after it was over.
I see your point.
Yeah, it was a very, for us, it was this real like snake eating its tail moment. And then, you know, again, as I was pointing out earlier, like people, when you say something on the show that people have been saying to their friends and families, sort of something, for instance, like, I don't feel like she's being treated fairly. When we say it, they just assume that we're 100% in support of them. When in fact, you know, there were things in that sketch that were critical of Hillary Clinton as well. But, you know, they picked out the part they wanted to hear and were huge fans of it.
Is there any political disagreements between the writers on Saturday Night Live? Are there Democrats and Republicans on the staff, or do you basically agree politically and what the political point of view should be of sketches?
There are both. There are disagreements. I mean, I'll be honest with you. There are more Democrats than Republicans, but certainly with Hillary and Barack, it was a more even split.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a really interesting time on the show. But as much as people would sort of make their points, in the end, and I should say this about sort of everything we've been talking about today, like if it's not funny, it'll never end up on the show. And when you try too hard to make a point, that's when it tends to get a little less funny. So as long as you made the argument that like, look, I think this is pulled from reality, it's working, we're going to have to do it. And more often than not, that works with people, whether they agree with the politics of it or not.
What is the job of the head writer?
The best way to describe it is you're sort of the... all the writers are surgeons and you're the emergency room doctor. It's constantly, it's just triage. The thing that most needs attention, you sort of have to drop everything and sort of give a hand to. But most of the stuff on our show, you know, unlike other sort of shows, be them, you know, other comedy shows or dramas, or, we don't have like a staff meeting where we lay out what everybody's going to go work on. Tuesday night, sort of everybody goes off on their own. They write what they think is funny. We have a lot of different talented people with a lot of different tastes. And so because of that, our show doesn't really have a consistent tone, which I think is one of the great things about our show. Some people, I think, don't like that because they'll see like a couple things they like and a couple things they hate. I've always thought the best SNL is three things you love and one thing you hate. So as head writer, you know, you just sort of – I run a rewrite table with all the writers where we sit around and pitch jokes based on what's already written. But each writer sort of gets to usher their piece through from, you know, the beginning stages to the final, you know, when it airs. Each individual writer casts their piece. They talk to set design. They talk to wardrobe. The most fun is between dress and air. If Lorne sort of needs a minute out of a piece as a head writer, you sort of get to go sit down with the writer and try to find how you're going to take a minute out of something. It's when it moves the fastest, it's when it's the most fun.
You're in the position of having to tell people no also, to tell a writer, this isn't going to make the final cut.
I'm so glad that that's actually not true because it really is the greatest process where between dress and air, everything's on a note card. And when Lorne calls the meeting between dress and air, you walk in and it's like finding out if you made the high school play or not. Your note card is either on the air side or on the cut side. So I actually very rarely have to give bad news. I'm just in the room when I see people's faces register the bad news.
Do you remember the very first time you heard Don Pardo say your name?
I do. It was the craziest thing ever.
I should say Don Pardo's the announcer on Saturday Night Live. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I started, my first show was the first show after 9/11.
That was your
so
first show.
That goodness. Was my first show, which was a crazy time to be starting on the show. And the only sketch I was in, I played a fish's head. A floating fish's head, which means I had to wear a green leotard because I was in front of a green screen, and my face had to be painted green. So I was in a green leotard with a face painted green, wearing a bathrobe, standing next to a bunch of police officers and firemen. The first time I heard Don Pardo say my name, and I realized that with everything that was happening in the world, it was the most insignificant part of the night. But it was, for me, incredible.
Seth Meyers, it's really been fun to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Seth Meyers is Saturday Night Live's head writer and the co-anchor of Weekend Update. Our interview was recorded in October. We'll hear from Tina Fey in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes. From the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Tina Fey tells us how she prepared to play Sarah Palin on Saturday Night Live. Stephen Colbert talks about the night that Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, and Barack Obama were all guests on The Colbert Report. And music critic Milo Miles considers the 25th anniversary of Hearts of Space, a public radio program devoted to New Age, ambient, and world music. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're featuring interviews with three of the people who helped make this a great year for political satire. And I'm not talking about the politicians, I'm talking about the satirists. Earlier in the show, we heard from Saturday Night Live's head writer and Weekend Update co-anchor Seth Meyers. He wrote most of the Sarah Palin sketches featuring Tina Fey as Palin. Fey was the head writer of the show and Weekend Update co-anchor before leaving to start her sitcom 30 Rock. I spoke with Tina Fey in November, just before the election. A few weeks before that, Sarah Palin had been a guest on Saturday Night Live, and she very briefly shared the stage with Tina Fey. That edition opened with Fey as Palin at the podium for her first press conference.
First off, I just want to say how excited I am to be in front of both the liberal elite media as well as the liberal regular media. I am looking forward to a portion of your questions, so let's get started. Yes, you.
Yeah, what were your thoughts on Senator McCain's debate performance Wednesday?
You know, I just thought he was great because the American people are angry, and John McCain is angry too. And you can tell he's angry by the way he sighs and grits his teeth, and he's always going like, "Grr!" You know, and that Barack Obama, well, if he's angry, I certainly can't tell. His words are smooth. When he's talking, it's like an angel whispering in your ear. He makes John McCain sound like a garbage truck unloading trash at a landfill. So to answer your question, yes, I think John McCain did great. You guy.
Yeah, at a rally in North Carolina this week, you said that you'd like to visit the, quote, pro-America parts of the country. Are there parts of the country that you consider un-American?
Oh, you know, that was just my lame attempt at a joke, but, yes, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Delaware, California. But then also, too, you have states like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Florida, which could be real, real anti-American or real, real pro-American. It's up to them. And now I'd like to entertain everybody with some fancy pageant walking.
Tina Fey, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on all the work you've been doing. When Sarah Palin came on the national stage, it was as if Americans around the country simultaneously said, "Tina Fey, she looks like Tina Fey." So what do you do to become her physically? And then we'll talk about what you do to be her verbally.
Well, physically, I wear a wig, obviously, that's modeled after her hair. At my request, we glue my ears back because my ears stick out pretty significantly and hers do not. And we overdraw my lip line because she has fuller lips and she has the I don't know if there's a term for this, but the pointy part on your upper lip, the sort of doll baby part of her lips are much further apart than mine. These are all things we've noticed in the makeup chair as we try to make me look like her. I try to stick my jaw out because she has a stronger jaw than I do. And I have a smaller mouth in general, so I try to make my mouth a little wider.
Now, how did you go about studying her voice so that you could get it and her vocal mannerisms?
I watched her a lot on YouTube. I watched the convention speech, and I watched, obviously, the Katie Couric interview the week that we did that. And because I'm not an impressionist, I started to try to work from the accent backwards because she does have a distinctive accent, and dialect works at work and stuff. Dialect work was something that I was kind of good at in my college acting days. We used to have a dialects course. So I started working backwards from that and really just trying to match, instead of words like deal, she says dill. She has what we call an substitution. See, my theater degree is really paying off. And she has those kind of Minnesota O's and really hard R's. And when she's being sort of sassy, when she's, taking a shot at someone, her voice tends to get higher. The example being, I guess being a mayor is kind of like being a community organizer. She gets pretty pleased with herself up there in the upper register. And then I also tried to think about, I hope that somehow my college acting teachers hear this because they will be proud that I tried to think it through this much. But I did also try to think of, people speak differently when they're doing public speaking. And so there's a little bit of a difference between the one where I'm supposedly kind of giving a speech and then the one where I'm talking to Amy as Katie Couric. Because people kind of
Can you demonstrate how you hear the difference?
Well, there's a kind of a speech cadence of like, John McCain and I are going to the White House. Like there's a different cadence that people use when they're on the stump and than when they're just speaking to another person.
And speaking to another person, you'd sound like?
In that Katie Couric one, she was way more intimate and she was, she was really more chatty. And but as compared to the one that is the debate one, I felt like she kind of, had the spirit of a very well-prepared high school debate captain, you know, and that she was confident in her answers and the ones that she had practiced. There was a, she was confident, but it was because she had studied for the test.
Well, since you mentioned the vice presidential debate sketch on Saturday Night Live, we've put together a collection of excerpts of you from that vice presidential Saturday Night Live debate. So why don't we hear that? So This is my guest, Tina Fey as Sarah Palin, with Queen Latifah as the moderator, Gwen Ifill.
You know, John McCain and I, we're a couple of mavericks. And gosh darn it, we're going to take that maverick energy right to Washington and we're going to use it to fix this financial crisis and everything else that's plaguing this great country of ours.
How will you solve the financial crisis being a maverick?
You know, we're going to take every aspect of the crisis and look at it, and then we're going to ask ourselves, what would a maverick do in this situation? And then, you know, we'll do that.
Senator Palin, address your position on global warming and whether or not you think it's man-made or not.
Gwen, we don't know if this climate change, whoosie, what's it, is man-made or if it's just a natural part of the end of days. I'm not going to talk about that. I would like to talk about taxes, because with Barack Obama, you're going to be paying higher taxes, but not with me and my fellow maverick. We are not afraid to get mavericky in there and ruffle feathers and not got to allow that. And also to the great Ronald Reagan.
Governor Palin, would you extend same-sex rights to the entire country?
You know, I would be afraid of where that would lead. I believe marriage is meant to be a sacred institution between two unwilling teenagers. And for those Joe Sixpacks out there playing a drinking game at home, maverick.
That's so great. That's my guest, Tina Fey, as Sarah Palin on Saturday Night Live. Oh, you were so fantastic in that. Now, you were talking about how you got the voice for that, and you described that as the high school debate kind of sound, the practiced kind of sound.
For that one, and when she came out, she said, "Can I call you Joe?" And she just was, you know, you could tell she was, it was just, you could feel that all, everything that she was going to say was planned, which is, you know, how they all are in that. But that was just something I tried to use.
And was this joke yours about marriage as a sacred institution between two unwilling teenagers?
That joke, I believe, is mine also, yeah. And I think that's probably the toughest joke we've done in any of those. And so, you know what I mean? It's maybe the harshest joke because it gets close to being about her own life, which, but in some ways it was one that I did it, and it's one of those ones that had a little tinge of like, oh, did we just do that? But at the same time, this is a person who is trying to, you know, who is talking about the issue of marriage and who's allowed to get married and who's not, and it seemed to me to be an interesting connection to make.
Well, you got to go. I want to thank you so much for talking
thank
with
you,
us, and congratulations on the show and your Sarah Palin impressions. Thank you again.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure.
Tina Fey recorded in November, just before the election. Coming up, Stephen Colbert talks about his satirical coverage of the election on the Colbert Report. This is Fresh Air. We're ending the year with entertaining interviews from 2008. We're featuring political satirists today. A couple of weeks after the election, I spoke with Stephen Colbert about his satirical campaign coverage on his Comedy Central program, The Colbert Report. Let's talk a little bit about what it's been like for you covering the campaign and now covering the election of a new president. Let's start with how you opened your show the day after Election Day, the first day that Barack Obama was president-elect.
Tonight, Barack Obama has been elected president.
my rage will be historic. Then, has Obama's election already changed America? Yes, but don't worry, not the real America. And I sit down with civil rights pioneer Andrew Young. I'm not sure what we'll talk about now that racism is over. I didn't vote. If I wanted to stand in line for hours, I would be an audience member at my show. This is the Colbert Report.
That is such a great intro. You got so much into that.
I did.
Now, this is probably the first time, I think it's the first time, that you've had an interaction with a man who became president before he became president. You had Obama on your show. I don't know if it's the only time you had him on the show, but when you did your show from Philadelphia in the spring, and this was the week that one of the debates was in Philadelphia, one of the primary debates, and the last night of your week in Philadelphia, you had on, it was an incredible night. I think it was like one of your best shows ever, and it was a particularly great show for me because I was in the audience watching it. You had on Hillary Clinton, and then we knew that Hillary was going to be on, but this surprise guest where John Edwards was there doing the word, and then...
The Edwards.
Oh, the Edwards. Oh, yeah, that's right. And then the huge surprise was the show ended with Barack Obama live from a remote location where he was doing a rally interacting with you. Tell us a little bit about what happened behind the scenes to make a show like that work where... You had on Clinton, Edwards, and Obama, and a lot of Secret Service people.
A lot of
involved
Secret Service
with one
people.
Show. Yeah.
Well, we didn't know whether it was all going to come together. We had invited everybody to do this, but we didn't know if everybody was going to make it. We didn't know for certain until the middle of the week whether Mrs. Clinton would be making it, and we didn't know until quite late that day whether Mr. Obama would be making it. We knew Mr. Edwards would be coming. We'd written the thing, and he'd approved the script that we'd done for him already. But the show was going up late, and we wanted Obama's appearance to be a surprise, partly because we didn't want to set up expectations of something that we didn't know whether it was necessarily going to get pulled off. But to the point where I said, don't even put it in the script. Like, I don't want anybody to see this in case it doesn't happen. So, like, even my stage manager's like, what's happening in the fourth act? I'm like, we'll see. We'll see what's happening. And the Obama people were ready to go 10 minutes before we were ready to get to his section of the act. The whole night was a tightrope walk.
You know, so... I have to say, here you are going through this like behind the scenes nightmare because you don't know if the show's going to work. You don't know if you have your fourth act and if Obama's going to make it or not. You don't have the satellite feed. But at the same time, you wanted to keep the audience entertained. So you came out during one of these like long technical delays. We're just waiting there. You came out and you literally stood on your head to entertain us. And I thought, if that is not the highest level of show business, someone who's under this pressure, everything's on his shoulders, but he's worried about keeping the audience entertained and the downtime, so he's going to stand on his head for us.
It's all worthless if we lose you people. We don't, we're not doing it for our health. We're doing it for laughs.
And then after standing on your head, you said, ouch, that really hurt. I think I threw my back out. Did you really? Because I was worrying about
you. Oh, yes.
You did?
Because I was like jumping around and I turned to my stage manager and I said, just catch my feet. And I did a handstand. And he held my feet. Now, the audience is going crazy. And it was really nice. But it was so loud that what my stage manager could not hear me say is, let go of my feet.
Oh, God.
Let go of my feet. And I'm screaming it at the top of my lungs. Let go of my feet. Because my arms are about to give out. And I'm going to snap my neck. And finally... I hear over his headset people from the studio, from the control room going, let go of his feet, let go of his feet, because they can hear me through my mic.
Oh.
And I really did hurt my back. It took a while to get over that little moment. But, one of the most fun things about that week was, I really wanted that show to have everybody on it, that final show. And, I don't ever want the show to be, for what everybody might think of the show, I don't ever really want it to be a hostile environment for my guests. My character is aggressive and my character is egotistical, but I really want my guests to have a good time, and to have fun. And so I knew that we would be honored to have those three guests on that night. And we worked very hard to find a joke and a game for John Edwards to do, and happily he came on and did it. And then we worked just as hard to say, like, what is the message that Hillary wants to get out? And the message is of competence, handling emergencies. So we created an emergency for her to handle, which happened to be my big rear projection screen behind me going out. And then she came in and fixed it. And we just had a lot of trouble figuring out what Obama's problem was. Like, what was the thing that he would even want to talk about on the show? And it seemed to me, it occurred to me at around noon the day that we wanted him, and they had said they couldn't make it at this point, that his message was he was being hounded by petty political distractions, like the flag pin issue. Like, why don't you wear a flag pin? And that's one of the issues that had been brought up in the debate that week. And so we had the on notice board, which is this board I use to put things on notice that I don't believe, you know, that I'm suspicious of. Things like, you know, the black hole at the center of the galaxy, or Lutherans, you know, or grizzly bears. They're all on notice. And so I said, let's see if Barack Obama would be willing to come on the show to put petty political distractions officially on notice. And so we quickly wrote a script in which he did that, appearing on this 25-foot-high rear projection screen right behind my head, which is what we had for the set in Philly. And at the very end of the show, I said, well, it was a great week. Thanks for having us. I only wish that Barack Obama had a chance to stop by. And then he just appeared on the screen behind my head. And he said, so do I, Stephen. And then, you know, then we did the scene. But the excitement of putting yourself in – I love being in situations where I feel like I'm in trouble. Like I've said, such and such will happen, but I don't know how to make it happen. And it reminds me, like Ernie Kovacs said, that every good idea he ever had was because it was 3:15, he had a 3:30 production meeting. And I'd say that's one of the things that is like the most fun for me on the show, and maybe the thing that's eventually going to kill us on the show, is that we love trying to do something that we probably shouldn't get away with or that we shouldn't be able to achieve.
So we're almost out of time, but I want to save a moment to ask you an important question. A lot of people have paid tribute to you. There's a spider named after you. Yes. There's various animals, a plane named after you. There's an edition of Spider-Man in which you're a character. So if I want to pay tribute to you on Fresh Air, what can I do?
You already did it. On your 20th anniversary show, you ended the show with the ending that you and I did.
That's
on
right.
The first time I was on your show. And I accidentally caught it. I had dropped my kids off at school and I was listening to the radio, the rebroadcast, and I sat in the driveway. I had one of those driveway moments, and I listened to the last half of your best of 20th anniversary show, and you got all the way to the end, and I was like, oh, I wish I'd made her best of show. And then I was the last thing on it. It was our goodbye. It was the last thing on your 20th anniversary show. And so you've already done it. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, it was the place of honor.
Yeah,
the final
think so.
Note.
Wherever I would have been, I would have considered the place of honor, but happened to be the actual place of honor.
Yeah. And I want to end with you and John Legend singing a duet of the national anthem from one of your shows in Philadelphia. And you get to sing some really deep notes as you sing harmony with him. I mean, you can go high and you could go real low in your singing. Is this about as low as it gets, as we're going to hear in this?
Yeah, I imagine so. I imagine so. That day I became a man.
Stephen Colbert, thanks for coming on our show. It's always so great to talk with you.
Thanks for having me back.
And thank you so much.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched, were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Who say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free? the home of the brave.
That's Stephen Colbert and John Legend. Colbert is the host and executive producer of The Colbert Report on Comedy Central. Our interview was recorded last month. Coming up, music critic Milo Miles on the 25th anniversary of Hearts of Space, the public radio program devoted to New Age, ambient, and world music. This is Fresh Air. The New Age music show Hearts of Space has just begun celebrating its 25th anniversary as a national show with a Best of Hearts of Space series of albums. Hearts of Space began as a late-night show on KPFA-FM in Berkeley, California, and went national a decade later. It's now heard on about 250 NPR stations. Hearts of Space has come far in 25 years, and critic Milo Miles explains how his attitude toward its style of music has also evolved.
I'll admit it, when New Age music first took off in the early 1980s, I regarded it as the enemy. It was a time when everything seemed to be going dewy and soft. Punk was mellowing into new wave. What had been noisy progressive rock and steely electronic experiments was being reduced to this creamy smoothness. There was no resistance, no crusading, and vocals like crooning wood nymphs floating over misty valleys. Yes, it's easy to poke fun at New Age, or as Stephen Hill, who started Hearts of Space with the late Anna Turner, likes to call it, space music. Whatever the name, you probably have a strong, if slightly indistinct, idea about the sounds I'm talking about. Many performers filed under New Age resist the granola hosanna connotations. They point out that impeccably hip albums such as jazz flautist Paul Horn's Inside and Terry Riley's Rainbow in Curved Air are clearly meditative precursors of New Age. The Best of Hearts of Space series begins with the initial broadcast, which includes performers as austere and focused as anyone could ask. A good example is the German multi-instrumentalist Deuter. Master jazz critic Martin Williams once dismissed New Age superstar pianist George Winston by declaring he could teach anyone to do what Winston did in 3 hours, even though he did not play piano. It's a marvelous essay, but a bit beside the point. Williams offers a variant of the three chords in a cloud of dust criticism of punk rock. Sure, anyone can do it, but not just anyone. It's what Winston does with his ultra-simple chops that attracted and held a considerable audience. I know I couldn't do that after 3 hours of instruction, and neither could Martin Williams. The standout tracks on the Best of Hearts of Space do an end run around analysis, like Thomas DeHartman's composition for the sly guru Gurdjieff, or Charles Lloyd's spiritual quest number, which isn't as faceless as it might have seemed back when New Age was a menace to noisy music. So I recommend Best of Hearts of Space, program number one, First Flight, to those mildly skeptical about the whole field. New Age has not exactly become my friend, but I do respect its game.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. He reviewed Best of Hearts of Space, program number one. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Fritz Snyder and Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, two stars of one of the funniest sitcoms on TV, The Office. We hear from Rainn Wilson, who plays Dwight Schrute, the power-hungry authoritarian and very odd assistant to the regional manager, and Jenna Fischer, who plays Pam Beasley, the very sane and ironic receptionist. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.